My name is Sir Andrew Davis. I'm the music director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and the subject of this commentary is Mozart's opera La Clemenza di Tito. Clemenza is an opera about legacy. What do I mean by that? One might think that legacies are involved because so much real-life death surrounded the opera, and people tend to think about their legacies towards the end of their lives. The work was commissioned in July 1791 and premiered on September the 6th of that year. By the end of 1791, the 35-year-old composer would be dead, having succumbed to some kind of fever that he contracted while he was in Prague for the premiere of Clemenza. Leopold II, the king for whose coronation the opera was commissioned, would himself be dead 6 months after the premiere, and his death, like Mozart's, would be fodder for conspiracy theories for centuries. Leopold's sister would also soon be dead, although in her case, there wouldn't be much doubt about the cause. Her name was Marie Antoinette. Interestingly, the subject of Clemenza, the Roman Emperor Titus, also died within 2 years of his coronation, and as in the cases of Leopold and Mozart, there was a suspicion of poison. But monarchs and politicians do not need the shadow of death to make them worry about their legacies. Clemenza was commissioned for the coronation of Leopold as King of Bohemia. In these days of televised royal weddings and jubilee celebrations, we tend to think of coronations as big parties, sort of like opening night parties at the opera, but with even more jewellery. There has often been this aspect to coronations. But in an age when ancient monarchies were under attack, first in the Americas and then in Europe, a coronation was a good time for a public show of legitimacy, legacy, and tradition. Clemenza was written to establish a legacy for a new king. The shadow of death that hung over the piece also made it a legacy in another way. We expect a great artist to go out breaking new artistic ground, and this often has been the case. Schubert's unfinished symphony, Beethoven's final string quartets, Giuseppe Verdi's bringing out Falstaff at the age of 80, when everyone, including the composer, thought his catalogue was closed. There's no reason to think that Mozart was thinking about any such thing when he wrote Clemenza. If he had any such thoughts, it's far more likely he would have reserved them for the Requiem he was writing around the same time. True, the composer had already contracted the illness that would cause his death, but 4 weeks after the opening of Clemenza, Mozart was back in Vienna presiding over the preparations for Magic Flute. Flute was his last premiere, but Clemenza was the last one he composed, possibly in a mere 18 days. It is Mozart's admirers who, with his death in their minds, have sought for 2 centuries to explain his final operatic commission in terms of legacy. Great artists tell us stories, and we return the favour by trying to find a dramatic arc in their actual lives. It's here that we run into a problem, because Clemenza on its face appears to be a step backward, not forward, for the composer. For starters, it was written in a form, opera seria, that had long been in decline. The reason for the choice of form was clear enough. Opera seria had always been associated with court functions. It was ornate and complex, dealing with noble, though not necessarily tragic, characters and subjects. A coronation was no time for a light singspiel or an opera buffa. It was time for art, in its most serious capital A trappings, art that reminded people of great, stable monarchies of the past and that dealt in noble and ennobled subjects and characters. The hero, a fictionalized Roman emperor, was also a throwback necessitated by the commission. A royal coronation required a suitable theme, and that meant something drawn from classical antiquity. Titus, Tito in Italian, was crowned Emperor of Rome in 79 AD, succeeding his father, the Emperor Vespasian. Never mind that in this same century, Rome had suffered through a civil war as the empire replaced the ancient republic, or that Titus was the first Roman emperor ever to succeed his father. The 9 emperors before him had variously gotten their posts through conquest, assassination, and bribery. To the 18th century mind, the Roman Empire was a time of peace and glory, stemming from the divine right of kings, a concept that had not yet been invented and would certainly not have been accepted by the Romans. If the form and the subject of Clemenza make it look moribund instead of forward-thinking, the problem was exacerbated by the choice of librettist. The writer Pietro Antonio Domenico Trapassi Metastasio was dead and had been for almost 10 years. Still, as the most successful Italian poet and librettist of his day, Metastasio was a natural choice for a coronation opera. His text for La Clemenza di Tito was all about praising a just and merciful ruler. If it had already been set to music by many composers, that only proved its worth. For all that, in many ways, Clemenza is an important part of the Mozart legacy. If the opera was not groundbreaking for the composer, it was groundbreaking for opera seria. As we will see, Mozart at once followed and developed the form, adapting and changing rules when they got in his way, but always respecting the basic premise. Our musical heritage would have been poorer had Mozart not composed it. The opera has 6 characters. Remember that Tito, the Emperor of Rome, inherited the empire from his father Vespasian, who won the title after a brief civil war. The previous emperor, who was killed by Vespasian's soldiers, was Vitellio, and Vitellio had a daughter. We don't know his daughter's real name, but Metastasio, and therefore Mozart, simply feminizes her father's name from Vitellio to Vitellia. It is her anger over her father's fate that drives the events of the opera. The third character is Tito's friend Sesto, a young patrician who has the misfortune to be in love with Vitellia. Then we have Sesto's sister Servilia, say that 3 times fast, and Servilia's boyfriend Annio. The cast is rounded out by Publio, the head of the emperor's elite Praetorian guard. After a substantial overture, the story opens with Vitellia trying to convince Sesto to assassinate the emperor. The excerpts you will hear are from an EMI Classics recording featuring Justo Wimberg as Tito, Carol Vaness as Vitellia, Christine Barbeau as Servilia, Dolores Ziegler as Sesto, Martha Zen as Annio, and Laszlo Polgar as Publio. Riccardo Muti conducts the Vienna Philharmonic. Special thanks to EMI Classics for providing the recording and to Nicholas Ivor Martin for his help in preparing this commentary. What you just heard is the fast-paced secco, or dry recitative, in which most of the plot is laid out. Rather than stab or poison the emperor, Sesto's rather indiscriminate plan is to burn down the capitol building with the emperor inside. But Vitellia uses a little wordplay to make her point that Sesto is all talk and no action. "It's always the same with you, Sesto," she complains. "Sempre lo stesso, Sesto." Using the Italian word for the same, lo stesso, next to his name, Sesto. Sesto is Mozart's Hamlet. You might expect that Vitellia wants Tito killed in revenge for the death of her father, but that is not the case. Had Vitellio lived, Vitellia would now be the daughter of an emperor. Vitellia is willing to kill Tito, but she's also willing to marry him if it can be arranged. Unfortunately, the emperor is more interested in Berenice. The role of Sesto was originally written for a castrato. Castrati were the superstars of their day, much more widely known than any mere tenor or soprano, but their best days had been mostly in the 1720s and 30s. By the premiere of Clemenza, the castrato, like the opera seria form, was something associated with an earlier generation. The divine Farinelli had been dead for 10 years, and Handel's famous castrato Senesino had been dead for 30. Interestingly, one reason that Mozart had received the commission for Clemenza so late seems to have been that the organizers were more interested in procuring the services of a famous castrato than of selecting a composer. That, and they offered the commission first to Mozart's more famous rival, Antonio Salieri. Salieri, however, was busy. In the end, the role of Sesto was premiered by Domenico Bedini, a castrato with a successful career but no superstar. Sesto asks Vitellia if there is any ruler in the world more merciful or heroic than Tito, but she's not impressed. She's upset that Tito is in love with Berenice, and not just because it means he doesn't love her. Berenice is a barbarian, unfit to be the wife of a Roman emperor. In real life, Berenice was a Jewish princess, the daughter of Herod Agrippa. Tito met her when he took command of the Roman army in Jerusalem, which he did to free up his father to return to Rome. Since his other project while in Jerusalem was to burn down the Second Temple, history has a decidedly different take than Metastasio on the quality of Tito's mercy. The first set number of the opera is not, as you might have been expecting, an aria. After all, the principal nugget of composition in an opera seria was the da capo aria. One of the complaints against the form was that it often devolved into a seemingly endless evening of arias. The action was typically divided between arias, in which the characters delved into the emotion of their situation, their thoughts and feelings, and recitative, quick, lightly accompanied musical phrases in which the singer seemed to be almost speed-reading through the plot. The da capo aria itself had a highly structured musical form. It began with an opening A section before moving on to a contrasting B section. The term da capo means from the beginning and refers to the final section, which returned to the music and key of the opening A section, but with added ornamentation and variation. In its original form, the composer might not even write out the music of the last section at all, leaving it to the singer to improvise a showy finish. Opera is about brilliant singing, but audiences and composers alike came to feel that opera seria was too much about the individual singer. Without duets, trios, and larger ensembles, with too much separation between the emotional content of the evening and the actual plot, with the orchestra in an almost completely subservient role, something was missing. Mozart was writing an opera seria, but he was too mature a composer to follow any formula slavishly. In the duet that follows, Vitellia tells Sesto to take care of Tito, or forget about ever earning her love. Sesto capitulates. Sesto's friend Anio arrives with news that Tito has sent Berenice away. The emperor apparently has no intention of marrying a foreign barbarian. Vitellia's hopes revive, and she tells Sesto to delay carrying out his plans. In her first aria, she tells Sesto not to mope and be suspicious. The aria ends with a wonderful Metastasian phrase that doesn't entirely translate. "He who expects deception invites it," the poet has Vitellia declare, but he uses similar-sounding words for expect, or really await, aspetta, and invite, really tempt, aletta. Chi sempre inganni aspetta, aletta ad ingannar. Metastasio was such a beloved librettist because his language was itself intensely musical. Anio has actually come for the hand of Servilia. They are in love, but they need the emperor's consent to marry. And in a second duet, Sesto promises to help them get it. They leave for the capital, where the emperor is receiving the tribute of a chorus of Roman citizens and subjects. Mozart has interpolated a contrasting chorus as well as two brief orchestral marches to add drama to the scene. The people have brought gold tribute to build a temple for their beloved emperor, but Tito is more worried about his subjects. Mount Vesuvius has erupted, and the emperor insists that the treasure be used to repair the damage. His first appearance on stage is thus in an act of compassion, and it is swiftly followed by more good deeds. Tito loves Berenice, but as emperor of Rome, he knows he must marry a Roman woman. He therefore tells Sesto that he will marry Servilia. In one act of self-denial, the emperor is promoting his friend Sesto, whose sister will now be empress, promoting the stability of his empire by doing what would please his subjects, and honoring Annio, whom he sends to Servilia with the news of her ascension. He doesn't realize that he's breaking Annio's heart. Neither Sesto nor Annio has the courage to tell Tito how they really feel, but the emperor notices that his friends are not as enthusiastic as he had hoped. Annio tells Servilia, who is both shocked and upset. They say goodbye in a passionate duet. Even in its strictest form, opera seria didn't ban duets, but they tended to be used, as here, for the romantic leads to express their passion. Servilia decides to tell Tito the truth, and when she does, the generous monarch renounces his intentions and blesses Servilia's marriage to Annio. You see why critics over the ages have complained about a certain lack of drama. The plot of Clemenza is as much rite, R-I-T-E, as theatre, but then you get arias like Tito's, expressing gratitude that Servilia has had the courage to tell him an unpleasant truth. On her way home, Servilia runs into Vitellia, who sees in her yet another rival. At her wit's end, Vitellia tells Sesto that she will have him if he will assassinate Tito now. Sesto's answer, given in the aria Parto, ma tu ben mio, is the showiest of the opera, although with solo clarinet weaving around Sesto's every phrase, it's almost a duet. Parto Parto is also not in the classic ABA form. It starts, slowly enough, with Sesto begging Vitellia to be at peace with him.
Parto! Parto!
In a typical da capo aria, we would now expect to move on to a contrasting B section, but instead Mozart gives us an ornamented repeat of the opening A section. Only then does Sesto make his passionate commitment to assassinate Vitellia's enemy. And if Sesto's first statement of the B section is passionate, his second is explosive. Dramatically, Sesto is delivering the most passionate speech of his life. He's going off to burn down the capital and stab his friend to death. It makes no sense to end with a return to the placid A section, so Mozart breaks convention and sends him off with a bang. Listen after the big trill when Mozart separates each note with the rest, making it sound as though Sesto is so overcome that he's gasping for breath. What follows next is best described as, well, operatic. Anio arrives to tell Vitellia that Tito has chosen her to be the next empress. Not good. Remembering what she has set in motion, Vitellia becomes hysterical, which Anio and Publio mistake for excitement over the emperor's decision. At the capital, Sesto is having his own regrets. He has engaged friends to set fire to the capital, leaving him free to stab Tito. He expresses his doubts in an extended recitative with full orchestra accompaniment. But by the time Sesto realizes he can't go through with it, the Capitol building is already on fire. Sesto searches for Tito in the chaos, but ends up returning with the news that someone else has killed him. Sesto wants to confess his crime, but Vitellia tells him to be quiet. The scene is captured in a remarkable ensemble not in the original Metastasio plan. Mozart's dramatic instincts again override the dictates of the opera seria form to produce something unique and compelling. The first thing we learn as Act Two begins is that Tito is, in fact, not dead. Anio tells an astonished Sesto that the man he saw stabbed was not the emperor. Anio is equally astonished to learn that Sesto himself was the instigator of the plot. He begs his friend to confess to the emperor. Sesto's obvious remorse is evidence of his good heart. Sesto is not, as we know, a man who makes quick decisions. He consults with Vitellia about what to do. She tells him to flee, admitting that she's worried he will betray her participation in the plot. While Sesto is deliberating, Publio comes to arrest him. His co-conspirator has confessed. The evidence against Sesto is overwhelming, but Tito still believes in his friend's innocence. Sesto's trial is conducted by the Roman Senate, who, not surprisingly, find him guilty. The verdict stuns Tito, who, in an accompanied recitative, expresses both his horror over the crime and his remorse that the powerful never know who is truly a friend and who an enemy. Tito orders Sesto brought before him. The sight of the distracted prisoner moves the emperor to pity. But when Sesto refuses to explain why he committed his crime, Tito's anger is reawakened. The emperor, however, admits to himself that even if his friend is unrepentant, he cannot bring himself to sign the execution order. When Vitellia learns that Sesto has accepted his sentence without implicating her, she is torn by conflicting emotions. Relief that she has escaped, pity for her faithful lover, guilt that he is going to die while she will be crowned empress, and ultimately fear when she realizes that she must confess. The scene for the finale is set. Everyone is assembled in the amphitheatre where the conspirators are to be thrown to wild beasts. Before Tito can give the order, however, Vitellia kneels at his feet and confesses that it was she who put the plot against him in motion. But why? The emperor asks. Vitellia explains that her hatred of him sprang from jealousy. She wanted to marry him, and when she thought she'd been passed over, she sought revenge. Tito is astounded to find yet another conspirator, but he proceeds with his original plan, pardoning everyone, Vitellia included. The opera ends with the people praising the humanity of their ruler.